You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're very excited, Hunter and I. We are graced with the presence of Professor Joseph Henrich from Harvard University. And I want to give him the introduction I feel he has earned. He's a professor of human evolutionary biology at Harvard University. He also holds the Canada Research Chair in Culture, Cognition, and Coevolution at the University of British Columbia, where he is a professor in the departments of psychology and economics. And he is the co-author of Why Humans Cooperate. We are here talking about the book, The Secret of Our Success, How Culture is Driving Human Evolution, Domesticating Our Species, and Making Us Smarter. And I just love the book, and I know Hunter and I have had, I think, 3 one-hour conversations probably about the book. So, Professor, welcome to the mother of all shows, The Brian Callen Show. It should be really called The Brian Callen Hunter Mott Show, but I'm a narcissist.
Well, thanks.
So,
nice to be with
yes.
you.
So let me start by saying that I think, and I'd love you to sort of expound on this, I really, really love how you use the evidence, the scientific evidence from evolution, just whether or not people are lactose tolerant or the kind of enzyme they have in their saliva that allows them to break up tuber vegetables. The more we learn about how our bodies work from a biological perspective and an evolutionary perspective, it seems that the categories we use, like black, like white, like Asian, like Hispanic, actually tell you nothing about the differences and the similarities between human beings. They are anachronisms. They've always been dated ways of talking about our humanity. And I thought that was pretty amazing. It almost seems as though, in many ways, as a white European, I may have as much in common with a tribe from Tanzania as someone from West Africa. It doesn't black, white, and Asian are probably the worst ways to categorize.
Well, but I think you have to separate out, and I think the great genius of Joe's book is that he separates out humanity from culture. And, you know, in terms of humanity, yes, we're all the same, but in terms of culture, we're very different. Right?
Right, right. I mean, the stuff you were talking about before with the continental races, I mean, these are characterizations of immense numbers, widely varying populations of people. And the way natural selection works, it works much more at the local level. So the reason why a European can have this similar lactose processing capabilities as someone in Africa is because similar selection pressures popped up in parts of Africa and in Europe, which makes them similar along that dimension, but of course different on other dimensions, where some African foragers are more similar to Japanese, and, you know, it cuts all directions depending on which trait you're talking about. So knowing someone's race doesn't tell you very much about the selection pressures that their ancestors experienced.
But at the same time, I mean, if we're talking about black, white, Asian, or whatever, in terms of, you know, our ability to acquire culture, we're all broadly the same, but people identify with these things. And so if you identify with a particular group, then, you know, you adopt that group's values, beliefs, all of, you know, their perspective on the world. And so, you know, those categories can be useful in the sense, in the degree to which they feel an affinity with those people, because part of what you talk about in the book is the fact that we blindly copy the people who we identify with.
Yeah, one of the interesting things that are one of the cases I lay out in the book is that when we think about evolution, we have to think about genes and culture interacting. So in terms of how we think about different groups, say racial or ethnic groups, one aspect of our psychology is that cultural evolution actually went first and created different groups with different behaviors, say marked by different traits. So you know, you have one group in one place that only has some practice about rearing children or about how you treat your spouse. Another group at a different place has different practices. They speak different languages, and our minds seem prepared. Genes have evolved in order to allow us to navigate that social landscape. So when you see that someone speaks a different language, we have a machinery for inferring that they might have behaviors that go along with that and can be generalized to other people. So it's a way of kind of learning to navigate the space. As part of that, we preferentially learn from those who share our dialect or share our ethnic cues. So that's going to cause people who to clump in space in terms of their ideas, beliefs, and values.
Right.
Yeah, you were talking about that where if they did an experiment where professors were given a survey, and if the return envelope had a name similar or the same as theirs, they were more likely to fill it out and send it back.
Yeah, we have this similarity bias where we like people who have the same name, and that relates to these practices that you find in lots of small-scale societies where you have a special relationship with people who share your name, and you can build special relationships by people will sometimes change their names to match, or you might name a new child in a family of your friend with the same name.
So yeah, or you have the father who you think is the father name the child, and usually they'll name him after a grandfather or something, and that creates a bond.
Right.
One of the things, though, it seems that I got from the book was people identify with their race because they might have been forced to identify with their race. So if you share a common history of persecution, for example, or slavery in the case of the American African-American in this country, you're going to identify because you had to, because you were probably redlined, you were put in the same neighborhoods, everybody didn't get the same resources, blah, blah, blah. But I feel as though as we learn more about science, if we had known back then, if the way you categorize somebody who was darker by saying, for example, well, yes, they're darker, but that's because they have more melanin in their skin, which in fact means that they don't need, I guess they come from a hotter climate. So the way they process vitamin D is different than the way we do, or at least they had to evolve that way because there was just too much sun where they came from. So those people over there have less melanin in their skin, and therefore they need less sun to make vitamin D work for their bodies. If you categorize human beings that way, it seems to me that the whole notion of race would never have been as important, right? I mean, it seems that way. If you were to say foragers, hunter-gatherer foragers in a certain part of Africa have a great deal more in common with Japanese farmers from Okinawa than you do, Brian. It seems that the science is breaking down all the way we speak about each other. And in a way, I don't think it's going to stop tribalism or breaking us up into groups. I think we're going to do that along economic lines and already are. So it'll be a new set of problems. But anyway.
Yeah, the key is whether if you teach people that, you know, that the skin color is just about a particular set of genes that have to do with adaptation to the latitude that your ancestors lived in, whether they can internalize that in a way that changes their behavior towards others. And that might be tougher because we do have this tendency to latch onto these marker traits of which race can fit into. But one of the kind of prescriptions that I think thinking about all this does is if you can get people to, say, speak with the same dialect or dress in similar styles, that's actually a powerful way to erase this assumption of difference that you get with different racial groups.
But I think the interesting thing, right, is that in general, you know, all this stuff, it takes two to tango, right? And there's, like, Brian's natural narrative is towards, you know, defending the people who are less advantaged. But part of it is that if you were to try and come in and say to African-Americans that they should abandon Ebonics, and that might be a problem in terms of them being able to integrate into the wider society, or that, you know, their beliefs that they are somehow separate and different and better are getting in the way of them acquiring values that actually serve the modern world, then, you know, you would be shouted down. I mean, that's not these are not ideas that do well, for example, on campuses like Harvard.
Sure.
And part of that cultural exchange, I mean, if you really want to build a society committed to the principle that all men are created equal, then, you know, we have to be able to talk to each other, and you have to have a society where, you know, white people are allowed to say, well, this is my generalizable human experience. Is that true for you? And black people are able to say, well, that's my generalizable human experience. Is this true for you? And you can't.
Yeah, that's kind of why the book is so important.
Yeah.
But remember, as we always talk about, ideas move very slowly a lot of times. A guy like Professor Henrik will write a great book trying to get those ideas out of the book and into people's heads. is part of why we do this podcast.
Yeah.
It's our tiny contribution.
And in terms of, I think, serving the audience, I mean, I think part of what you have to do, right, you can't just simply, it's the old thing, right? You can't just give people a new idea. You also have to discredit and get rid of the old ideas. And so we've all internalized assumptions about what the secret of our success is. We think, oh, we're good at problem solving, or we're good at reason, or, you know, oh, it's because we walked on two legs or had opposable thumbs. So I'd really like to, I mean, if I was a listener, I would just want to have all of those ideas debunked one by one by Professor Henrik.
Take it away, Professor.
All right, where do you want to start?
I think reason. Let's kill that, okay. And let's kill that humans are good at theory making.
Yeah, okay. I mean, in other words, let me also paraphrase there, because you cited a number of examples with chimpanzees, with different primates, and how we're not actually better at a lot of things that we think we are.
Right, right. So one of the key questions they ask from an evolutionary point of view is, you know, what allows humans to have expanded across the earth and adapted to all these different novel environments and build fancy technologies? And I think the typical assumption is that it's something about our intelligence or our rationality or our ability to build causal models about the world that can help us figure it out. But you can do a simple thought experiment, which is take a group of people, say from Los Angeles, and deposit them or parachute them into the Ituri forest, and also parachute a group of capuchin monkeys, and they can play a game of Survivor. Now, the humans are going to need to be able to figure out how to find food, how to find water, how to protect themselves from predators. They're probably going to need some medicines at some point. And the capuchins are going to have to do the same thing. But, you know, if your intuitions are the same as mine, the monkeys are probably going to do a lot better than humans. And that's because the monkeys come already equipped with what they need to figure all that stuff out. But the humans are going to fail. They're not going to be able to do all those things. And that's because their brains aren't actually geared to be able to solve these problems, because we've become dependent as a species on this accumulation of cultural information, on the know-how to how to make the tools, to find the animals, and what kinds of foods we can eat. So we lack a lot of the innate taste cues and poison removal processes, physiological digestion processes that allow other animals to survive and thrive in their environments. So we become increasingly dependent on this body of information that we ourselves can't figure out. So one of my favorite examples is fire and cooking. So humans seem to have evolved to rely on fire. So we have to cook food in order to get enough calories out of the food. If you try to live on raw foods, it's actually pretty hard, and you get very thin, women stop cycling and whatnot. But if we cook it, then that allows us to get the calories out of it. But what's interesting is we don't know how to innately make fire or cook. We have to learn it from other members of our social group. So we're kind of we become a requisite cultural species. Now, the question is then, why do we seem so smart? Well, when you begin to look at it, we actually acquire a lot of information, a lot of our intelligence as a kind of cultural intelligence. So something like numbers. So we all acquired a numbering system that allows us to count without bound, and we can add and subtract and do all that stuff. But smaller scale human societies only count 1, 2, 3 many, and so they can't distinguish, say, 26 and 27. So that's just one example, and something like pulleys and wheels are things that are useful, and you can think with them once you've encountered them and learned about them, but they're hard to figure out the first time.
And so, because I think that, you know, we tend to think we've sort of internalized the myth of science, and we think that theory making is something that happens in labs and all of that sort of stuff. But the internet just shows us how innate our man's search for meaning or our attempts to make sense of things are. The difference is that most people don't systematically test their theories, right?
Right, right. So everyone's trying to understand the world and try to make sense of it. And the thing is, in the case of a lot of our theories that have worked in science, they've actually been driven by the products of cumulative cultural evolution. So things like our understanding of thermodynamics didn't lead to the steam engine. The steam engine led to our understanding of thermodynamics. So once you had a machine, it gave you a window on the world for which you were able to get a better understanding from it. So one way to think about science is just a series of rules about how to process information and what counts as a good argument. And it's, you know, it's been successful and spread because it seems to be better at doing at least certain things than other epistemologies or other sets of norms about how to evaluate evidence and differentiate amongst ways of thinking.
And so in terms of because you have that great graph, that great bar graph that Brian was referencing earlier in the beginning of the book about when you give an IQ test across a number of parameters to a chimp, an orangutan, and a toddler.
Right.
So could you tell us about that?
Yeah, sure. So these anthropologists at the Max Planck Institute in Leipzig, Germany, developed a battery of cognitive tests. And these, the cognitive tests had different areas. So there was tests about dealing with quantities and dealing with space. And in each case, the subjects had to figure out, they would get a treat, you know, some kind of food that they liked for each time they got the right answer on the cognitive test. And they gave this to 2.5-year-old children, chimpanzees, and orangutans. And they found that across a bunch of the different these different domains, the chimps and the humans were, and the 2.5-year-olds were pretty similar. So there didn't seem to be any innate difference in the ability to deal with space or quantities or even tool using. In fact, the chimps did a lot better than the kids in tool using. And the orangutans were a little bit below the other two primates, but not really far below.
Dummies, then, they're dummies.
No, but children are dumb. I think that's part of the big conclusion of this, right?
Yeah. And so that, but in the domain of social learning, the kids were basically at ceiling, and the apes, the other two apes, are both at floor. So there's this giant difference in this one cognitive domain, the ability to look at others and learn from what they have. Mm. And then this dovetails with another fact, which is that when you test young apes, so apes stop being infants around age 4 or 5, and then they become juveniles, and then they're adults after about age 11 or 12, their cognitive abilities don't change much from going from about 4 or 5 until they're adults. Whereas that 2.5-year-old, you know, his cognitive abilities or her cognitive abilities are going to keep going up for the next 2 decades at least of their lives. So they're just going to get smarter and smarter. And a lot of what's making them smarter is this big download of cultural heuristics and tools and learning about objects and all those things that give us kind of prefab solutions to lots of problems.
Well, that's kind of the fundamental difference then between humans and animals and primates is potential. That's the one thing that I think nobody can really explain. That's why it's. I'm not a very religious person.
Joe Henrich did explain it. I mean, well, I think that's the point. We can explain it. I mean, Brian, I know you have these mystical notions.
We can explain why. How that happens, but I don't think we can explain why. There's such a vast difference between human beings and, say, our smarter friends like killer whales and chimps and parrots. There's a vast difference.
Yeah, there's a vast difference, but the whole point is that this book does explain it. And in the context of all this, the other work and the people that we've
had. Is that my dog?
Yeah, I think so. But
hold on for a second.
Hey!
but the point is that we can explain it, right? I mean, that's the whole point.
Yeah, so I don't know if I should wait till Brian gets back, because I can give him the explanation that I lay out in the book.
Well, that's what I want you to do for us is convert Brian. Brian okay. has sort of relied on a certain idea that, you know, there, you know, this very romantic notion of, like, there's something ineffable that can't be explained, but it's important to understand what we're good at and what we do well so we can do it better.
Right.
Sorry.
So, Brian,
my dog, my puppy, my German Shepherd barks at everything.
Brian, are you ready to be converted to the new religion?
I am ready to be converted to the new religion.
So Brian, the case that I make in the book is that humans actually did go down a very particular and peculiar evolutionary path. And what drove it was, once we learn from each other with sufficient fidelity, then you get this second system of inheritance, this cultural inheritance system that's generating tools and technology and large bodies of know-how about plants and animals, how to make shelters and medicinal plant knowledge. And then our brains had to respond to this changed world, this world with all these different tools, technology, and know-how. So our brains adapt genetically to become better at acquiring, storing, and organizing all of this information that's being generated in this parallel inheritance system, this cultural inheritance system. But then the better the brain gets at that learning, the faster that cultural evolutionary system goes, the more of that kind of knowledge that it generates, and that puts more pressure on the brain. So you get this rapid expansion of human brains over the last 2 million years. And the argument is that the brains are specialized, they're cultural learning machines that allow them to ingest all this valuable information. Actually, we're downloading some basic processes that other animals have instinctually. So, for example, when humans give birth, the infant's nurse, and the colostrum in mammals is this important substance that first comes out of the breast before the milk that all mammals have to ingest in order to get their immune systems cranked up. And other animals automatically ingest that. They put it right on. Humans, some people will throw it away because they don't know that it's this valuable thing, so they just think there's this non-milk substance coming out of the breast. We got to get rid of this. So that's a case where you need to acquire biocultural information, and traditionally societies do, that, you know, the infant needs to ingest that colostrum. So it's this process that drove the kind of expansion of our human brains, and to understand this, you have to recognize that we're kind of a cultural acquisition machine. That's like the main thing we do starting from a young age as children.
Right.
You sound
like dangerously close to an atheist, and I'm outraged right now.
Well, but
the idea that God isn't around.
But I think this is also one of the important points is that, you know, so, you know, I don't know who did the original work, but certainly in Haidt's book, The Happiness Hypothesis, we now understand that the feeling of being connecting to your higher power, being lifted out of yourself, being one with nature, that's an emotion, and that's an emotion we all have, and that's why we have a spiritual hunger. It's as real of an emotion as happiness or joy
or
fear.
God. Yeah, it's where inspiration comes from. It's where doing good acts a lot of times come from. I know David Sloan Wilson talks about sort of how altruism can be an evolutionary byproduct. But at the end of the day, thank God for all of those emotions that sometimes, by the way, are not so good for survival, are they? But maybe they are collectively.
But Brian, it's like what atheists and religious people are arguing about is whether it's like a sad person saying, does happiness exist? And a happy person saying, does sadness exist? Because they're two opposing emotions. Like, if you connect to your higher power, that means you have to disconnect from your higher power. Like, right. You know, Christians don't walk around in this like magical air of Jesus all the time. Sometimes they have to pay their bills, and sometimes they have to pick up their kids from school, and so sometimes they become this very practical, ordinary person. And you know, we should stop trying to negate the value of both emotions, right?
Makes sense.
But I think the Cliff Notes version of everything that Professor Henrich said is that most animals have to change their hardware to become better adapted to the world. We get to change our software. We are the species that changes and downloads software.
Right, and that can explain a lot of the unusual nature of human brains and human thought and human behavior. That if you once you recognize that, you know, that it's for this software changing out that we evolved for.
And I think also in that context, I mean, I think part of, you know, we have all these, obviously we create gods, right? We you know, we have the eye god, you know, Edison was known as the Wizard of Menlo Park. Arthur Eddington specifically created the myth of Einstein to help move those ideas, right? Because those myths create the feeling of awe, and awe leads to blind copying. It's very hard to sell people on quantum physics, but if you can convince them that there is this magical boy wonder who has seen farther into the world, then everybody's like, oh, this is the new god. I'm going to worship the new god and believe in what he believes in.
Professor, why do you think that we are a species that creates gods?
Well, so I'd want to separate that. So I have a whole line of work on the evolution of religions and why it is that over human history we've seen gods go from relatively weak and whimsical gods in hunter-gatherer societies to these big, powerful, moralizing gods that we find in complex societies. And the case that we've made there is that believing in a god can actually cause groups of people to be more pro-socially, to have more harmony, to be able to extract the benefits of exchange more. And so this allows those groups to be spread and be more successful compared to other groups. And that over time has led to the spread of big moralizing gods and certain kind of rituals that help internalize beliefs in those gods. And there's a bunch of experimental work that we've put together that shows that those things do lead to greater pro-sociality. Now, in terms of
so then the conclusion is that that mythology is very important for ordering society and probably creating a profitable society, a society that's good for itself.
Well, a certain kind of society. The point is, going to say, remember that Kim Jong-un made himself into a god. Like, if you want a society that looks like ancient Egypt, then yes, you want that sort of god.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, our argument, we don't have any kind of, normative. We don't make a normative take on it, but we do think that the scaling up of societies, getting bigger, more cooperative, larger scale societies, was facilitated by a certain set of supernatural beliefs. And so if you want to understand why there's certain kinds of supernatural beliefs that are common in the world today, this process has influenced it.
Do you see something changing in our mythology now that the internet is so powerful and we can watch each other so closely? Do you see major changes in the way we are behaving, or at least our belief structures, or are they exactly the same?
Well, there's two things that are happening with the spread of potent secular institutions and kind of social safety nets. One is that in European countries, the sort of cooperation galvanizing effect of religion, that pressure to keep that in place seems to have gone away with these potent secular institutions that many European countries have. So there you're getting a spread of disappearance of organized religion, spread of atheism. That's happening in the U.S. too, but more slowly. The other thing that's happened that is interesting is that same pressure has caused people to shift away from believing in a punishing God to believing in a more kind of loving. So the number of people who believe in hell has gone down relative to the number of people who really emphasize heaven. And there's interesting experimental work to suggest, and actually global data, to suggest that hell does a lot of the work on keeping people in line.
Wow. Yeah, I would imagine burning in a hellfire for eternity sucks. I think I remember reading, I think it was Portrait of an Artist as a Young Man, and then James Joyce talks about the way his teachers, and I guess priests, would describe hell. Oh my God. You know, it was just designed to keep you trembling in your seat and probably never get out, or at least never step out of line.
No. But once you have these powerful secular institutions that begin to replace the functions of religion, those kind of unhappy things, which do a lot of social work, but are kind of unpleasant to think about, the cultural evolution shifts and begins to favor more of the stuff that people kind of like and makes them feel good, as opposed to the stuff that makes them better.
And so, but with the idea that hell is no longer. Do you think it doesn't seem that we are getting less moral, and we don't, and maybe this God, this sort of God of positivity, is, because you hear people all the time saying things like, you know, it's all love, dude. You know, you got to give back. It's like, right. You know, if that's your deal. There's all these things that have permeated, you know, I'm not religious, but I'm spiritual and blah, blah, blah. But it still seems that we are pretty ethical and pretty moral, as at least in this country, and certainly the people that I come into contact with from other countries.
So, I mean, the case that we make in this one paper that we published recently is that, you know, certain set of religious beliefs allowed for the scaling up of societies, but once you have modern societies with these potent secular institutions, the religious institutions and the religious beliefs are not holding the society together anymore.
Give me an example of potent secular institutions.
Well, non-corrupt police, courts that generally work, governments that generally work and don't do what Kim Jong-un does.
Institutions. That's where Darren Acemoglu and his colleague, whose name I always forget, comes in,
James Robin. Oh, wait a minute. Who are you talking about?
Why Nations Fail.
Yeah. James Robinson.
I love that book.
Yeah. But I think, lest we congratulate ourselves too much on, you know, our enlightenment. I mean, I think the point is that, exactly. Like, being a nice person, you know, when you have food and when you have a full belly and when you have working institutions, is much easier than, you know, when you're starving and all of that sort of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Hunger
oh, yeah.
makes monsters of all men, you know.
Sure.
No doubt.
And I mean, I'll never...
Wait, now, Professor, you're also working... Your next book is on the weirdness of Western culture, I think?
Yeah. So the about in 2010, some collaborators at the University of British Columbia and I, we put together all the psychological evidence we could find that compares Westerners to the rest of the world. And so it was quite a search, because 96% of all participants in psychology experiments are from Western societies. They're mostly American undergraduates. So the vast bulk of what we think we know.
Is that true?
Yes.
That's funny. Okay, so about same when
psychology,
you say Western...
Yeah. comes from studying American undergraduates, and then more broadly it comes from studying Westerners of one sort or another. So we looked for all the kind of rare studies in where you had a large global sample or some kind of significant cultural variation. And what we found in study after study, although not all, it's not, you know, 100%, but in a large bulk of these studies, Western societies are kind of the outliers, anchoring one end of the distribution compared to the rest of the world. Now, of course, there's still lots of cultural variation in the West of the world, but the Westerners were riding the tail of the distribution frequently.
And I think
so expand on that a little, because so when you say Western, you're talking about Western Europeans and you're talking about Americans and Canadians, I'd imagine, right?
Yeah, yeah. So I don't know. You guys are probably sitting in the weirdest place in the world.
Why? Because most of my friends are doing the ketogenic diet / paleo diet, where I constantly hear every day. This is a common conversation in Los Angeles. It starts like this. Ready? Hey, dude, I don't eat bread anymore. Dude, sugar is evil. You know that, right? You know it's a plot. It's an evil plot. That's the conversations that I engage in. It's great. Oh yeah, you mean you know did eat bread? Guys like Einstein and Newton and Shakespeare. But keep going. What were you saying? You bunch of paleo CrossFitters from California. You're so right. It's such a weird place. It is the weirdest place in the world. But I'm sorry. I digress.
Yeah. No. We're talking about Canada and the U.S., Australia, and then, you know, the Scandinavia, the Dutch, England, France, places like that, Germany. So Northern Europe and then the European descent societies. And, you can look at visual illusions, you can look at social behavior, you can look at these behavioral experiments where they give people sums of money and ask them to divide it up amongst others. Things like color terms, all kinds of areas of psychology. And so what I've been doing is trying to say, well, how can we explain these patterns of variation? What was it about the trajectory of European history that led to this psychologically peculiar population?
And part of it, so what are some of the parts of that? Because, I mean, the thing that springs to my mind is Jack Goody's work.
Yeah, yeah. So that's definitely part of the story. And so the question is,
First of all, the guy's name is Jack Goody. So what? Keep going.
Yeah,
is he a magician?
Jack Goody argues that the Catholic Church fundamentally transformed the family in Western Europe. So the Catholic Church spreads into Northern Europe and does away with polygyny and cousin marriage, which you might not, you know, most Americans don't think of cousin marriage as a big thing, but it actually dominates a lot of cultures around the world. Cousin marriage is popular. And all these other things that lead to what anthropologists call complex kinship. So in many societies, you have all these roles and responsibilities and obligations to other members of your family, and you kind of live in this web of complex kinship where you have to deal with all these roles and responsibilities. And what this new family structure did was it freed people up and allowed them to, you know, marry people by choice who lived far away from them, transact with strangers who weren't members of their clan or weren't part of some inter-clan alliance. So it basically kind of cracked open these complex kinship units and let people freed up their decision-making.
Yeah, I notice that it seems that the biggest part of our psychology is that we as individuals and our feelings as individuals are tantamount. They are paramount to everything. You know, my feelings, my sensibilities, and by the way, as an individual, I can change time. So there's this linear progression to time, and I'm a significant part of that large historical progression. Whereas that's not the case, I think, with Asian, with for example, Chinese or Japanese or Korean, from my experience, mythology. Right. The idea with them seems to be, and correct me if I'm wrong, that, you know, Americans like to think of themselves as the actual tree. Whereas if you talk to somebody who's from certain parts of China or Korea, well, I'm a tiny leaf on a very big tree, in fact. And right. And how I am rather insignificant, and my relationship to all the other leaves and that giant tree is what I think about. Do you think that's a fair characterization?
I think that's a great characterization. So, and that's really central. So one funny statistic is something called self-enhancement. So if you ask Americans, you know, are you a better than average driver? Almost everybody says they're a better than average driver, which is, of course, statistically impossible. Not everybody can be better than average. But if you do this in other places, it's much, much more accurate. People say, yeah, I'm actually not that good. And so that's an example of the way we really focus on ourselves. We're overconfident. We're self-enhancing. We overestimate our ability to affect the world. our relationships can be, you know, deep and powerful, but they can also be ephemeral. So we move to a new city, you make new relationships, you make new friends. Whereas in more traditional societies, people really have long and enduring relationships, and they're disinclined to break off one relationship to make a new relationship. So it's something that psychologists call relational mobility.
And that's particularly acute in Americans. I mean, I think one of the interesting things about, so for example, when we had Richard Nisbet on, you find that what cultures have said about each other for a long time is borne out, and it's that very sort of Christian idea of it's easy to see the splinter in your brother's eye and hard to see the log in your own. And the Brits have long said that, you know, oh, Americans, they, you know, you can become friends with them in 5 minutes, and that's about as long as the relationship will last. You know, whereas, I mean, Brits are much more like abused shelter dogs. Like, you really have to, like, there's a lot to overcome, but once that sucker's lawyer...
Abused shelter dogs, that's fantastic.
You will never, I mean, like, once that dog loves you, you will never, like, it'll follow you everywhere you go. So
that's my experience with Europeans, actually, with French people as well.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, there is a continuum here, and the U.S. is on the kind of far end of individualism. But even the Europeans, if you compare those to the rest of the world, they seem quite individualistic compared to folks in lots of places.
Yeah. And the other question that I have as I think about this weirdness is that obviously there are things that are unusual about it, us, like we don't suffer from the tyranny of cousins, but there's also always the danger, right? Every tribe seems to describe themselves as the people, right? They see themselves as the true people and that their view of the world is true. So isn't it possible that we're just weird in the same way as these people and that we don't, you know, see that we're actually quite normal?
Well, I mean, I'm sure there's lots of, you know, one of my main interests is human nature. So we're going to share lots of aspects of human nature with everyone.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of these certain package of the things that psychologists have been studying, you know, the things you'll find in psychology textbooks, it turns out that we're unusual in many of those.
Yeah.
So now it could be that we're particularly interested in those things because of our culture history and stuff like that. So the psychology textbooks reflect what European populations have become interested in over time. So it's really more a reflection of what people decide to put in textbooks rather than some kind of overall view of humanity.
Because, yeah, Jonathan Haidt has that thing in The Righteous Mind about how, you know, six, you know, core moral principles or values, and that, you know, that Republicans do a good job of tapping into all six, and that, you know, Democrats tend to only tap into three. And, you know, at the time I was like, oh, wow, that's interesting. But, you know, for example, one of the, now that Trump is doing well, you're seeing all these articles floating around about, you know, these are people who like authoritarians and like authority. And it doesn't seem to me like Democrats or liberals are any less in need of or desperate for authority. They just have different authorities, and those authorities tend to be scientists, and scientists don't tend to think of themselves as, you know, the high priests of the sort of a religion of liberalism.
Right.
So are we that weird? I mean, that's what I wonder.
Well, I mean, just there's at some level, of course, we're not. Like we just talked about earlier in the conversation about how we all use the cis cultural learning and we're all heavily reliant on that. We all preferentially learn from locally prestigious individuals and highly successful individuals. But then there are all these domains, like the individualism domains and the way we deal with relationships and the importance of cousins and things like that, which do seem to vary.
Yeah. But it's interesting as well. I mean, I think that because, you know, I had a slightly unusual experience when I was at Harvard, which is that, you know, my mother's family's from Kansas City. So, you know, I would simultaneously hear all these people talking about how terrible stereotypes are and people shouldn't stereotype. And then they would talk about people from the flyover states. And I was like, by definition,
they categorize all of them like this. I'm in my pickup truck now, and I like my guns.
by definition of the fact that you called them the flyover states, that means that you've never been there and that you know nothing about these people. My cousin who's Dutch on my dad's side, like he always would do the same thing. He'd be like, you know, you give an American a handgun and a hamburger, that's all he wants, that's all he cares about. And I was like, you know, and like Europeans have these very weird things that they say about Americans. They're like, Americans are so ignorant, they can't name all the countries in Europe, right? Like blah 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 blah. And then in the next sentence they'll talk about Arkansas, and I'm like, tell us more about Arkansas. What's your Kansas like? Do you mean
Arkansas?
Well,
that's why the Secret of Our Success is an important book to read.
Yeah.
It's the glue.
It really is. And I mean, I think, you know, it's what's so fascinating about all of these things, like Descartes' error, right? Descartes' error is all about the fact that, you know, I mean, essentially Descartes is sitting around with no MRI, nothing like that. And he comes up with an idea that reason and emotion are separate. And then we all sort of buy into it. It's one of these inherited myths. And it was, we shouldn't treat that myth with any respect because it was a person with very little evidence. And we should be looking at, like, we should all abandon everything that we've always believed and just restart from the Secret of Our Success. That's my feeling.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with that more.
Yeah.
Well, who are the thinkers? It's probably a difficult question because they all build on each other. But for you, give me the seminal thinkers, the people that kind of got you, I guess, even today, that kind of awe you, or who are your heroes, the leaders of thought that kind of, well, I guess maybe your biggest influences, Professor.
Yeah, I mean, by far my biggest influence has been Robert Boyd and Pete Richardson. So these are these anthropologists. Rob Boyd's now at Arizona State, and Pete's at UC Davis. And they really developed this idea of thinking about culture as an inheritance system. They were building on the work of two Stanford guys, Mark Feldman and Cavalli Sforza, who had begun to apply population genetics models to thinking about cultural evolution. And then this all leads to the idea that these two inheritance systems can interact, and then they did a lot of the kind of foundational mathematical work in developing the models. I also learned a lot from Dick Nesbitt, who Hunter and I spoke with not too long ago. My first job after graduate school was at the University of Michigan, and I hung out a lot in Dick's lab and learned a lot from him as well.
This was all culture and know-how you were accumulating.
That's right.
From your elders.
Yeah.
Well, and you know, we'll let you go here, but you do such a great job of describing what children we are in, you know, in new environments. The Inuit, for example, when you don't want to be in the Arctic unless you've got your Inuit friends with you, because if you don't know what a seal smells like, if you don't know how to kill a polar bear while it's sleeping in its den so you can harvest that extra hard bone to stab that seal, if you don't know how to find water, because ice water is all salty.
Right.
Man, oh man, did you do a good job of that? And it just goes to show you that there's no such thing as a tough guy. There's only you're not so tough when you're thrown into an environment you know nothing about. So
well, and I think also crucially, what's so important about to yes and what Brian is saying in terms of making sense of what's going on in the world right now is that if you lose your culture, you die. And so that's why people defend their beliefs so vociferously. And, you know, that what we don't do is that what we don't realize is we're not practicing that social intelligence. We just sort of trample all over other people's beliefs and are like, you're an idiot and all of that sort of stuff. And, you know, you shouldn't do that. Like, these people have, like, hardwired systems that are designed to, you know, really defend what they believe. And you should be coming in respectfully in the same way that you would come into a stranger's house and be like, I don't totally understand why you do the things that you do. Let's try and have a dialogue. Well,
yeah.
Right.
Professor. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, because, you know, you see so many people, Professor, that are not good missionaries. A lot of scientists are not good missionaries. They're not getting their message across to people that are not scientific-minded, people who are more religious. Lawrence Krauss loves to come in as this renowned physicist and tell you that everything you read in the Bible is written by peasants and it's a big fairy tale. Not a good way to break the ice, right?
But
how to win friends and influence people. He hasn't even read that book.
But also.
So do you find that's how do we do that? How do we bridge the gap? How do we do that? What's you're an expert.
Yeah, I mean, I think we need. Well, I think really there could be a specialization of labor here. So we need guys like you who help translate. Because the scientist, you know, Lawrence spends all of his time thinking about science, right? And so he's not thinking about kind of communication. So you can end up in these traps. I mean, obviously, we can all improve, but I think there's a real role for guys like you and science journalists and all to kind of do the full-time job of translation.
That's what I will try to do. I'll try to build that bridge, sir.
But we also,
Joseph Henrich, thank you for joining us here. I know you're
great
a busy guy.
You.
And so the book is The Secret of Our Success, How Culture is Driving Human Evolution, Domesticating Our Species, and Making Us Smarter. For me, it's a must read. You know, I have a podcast called The Fighter and the Kid, and we get over 3 million downloads a month. And I've been touting this book, talking about how we're going to be talking to you on this podcast. So let me know if your sales go up, because that'd be interesting.
Will do.
Yeah. Thank you, sir. And good luck with your next book. We can't wait to read it and have you back on.
Excellent. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
All right, Hunter.
Yeah, I just love that book, and it is a real privilege and a treat.
It's great.
Anyway.
It's great. I hope we let him speak enough. We were both talking a lot, but that's okay. I think we got the ideas across, and he's great.
That's the problem, you know, Brian, you know, when a couple of Bieber fans are around Justin Bieber, you know, all those words come spilling out because they're just so
excited to be next to their idol.
I mean, you know.
We know you and I are so smart that we fanboy on academics.
I think that it's not that we're so smart. I think we just fanboy on different things. You know, but that's okay.
I like categorizing myself as smart. Yeah. So kiss my ass.
I like to categorize myself as the same superstitious peasants that we've always been. And that, you know, we think that our superstitions are different, but you can't.
Well, I like thinking of myself not as superstitious, but as a tennis professional, and I'm going to go hit some balls, and I'm not going to keep score, but I work on my quote unquote stroke.
Wow.
And I make no noise too. Now I hit so hard.
Really?
I go, hey! and I don't need to, but it makes me feel awesome. So there you go. It's like going down a blue run and not a black run. When I got on the blue run, I go, hey, 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 when I change direction.
Yeah.
But I'm not really hitting any moguls.
So you feel that that's an important part of the ritual, because you're a superstitious peasant, to vocalize and make sacred noises when you hit the tennis ball?
Listen, Lawrence Krauss, I'm not talking anymore. Hunter, I love you.
I love you too, Brian.
America, this has been the Brian Callen Show. And featuring Hunter Motzen. Of course, the great Professor Joseph Henrich. The book again, The Secret of Our Success. Read it or die.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.